My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. So glad to have you here with us because this is one of my favorite episodes of the podcast so far. I'm pleased to present with you a conversation that I taped with John Lurie. Maybe you know John from his work in movies like Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Paris, Texas, The Last Temptation of Christ, or many more. Or maybe you know him better as a musician with groups like The Lounge Lizards, his trailblazing avant-garde jazz unit, or his fictional blues man persona, Marvin Pontiac, or maybe you know the John Lurie National Orchestra. Or maybe you know him best from his pioneering and singular television shows, like 1991's Surreal Nature program, Fishing with John, or the more recent Painting with John, which ran for 3 seasons on HBO from 2021 to 2023. The soundtrack to that last show, composed by Lurie and recorded with longtime New York City creative music scene collaborators like Steve Bernstein, Doug Weisselman, Billy Martin, and his brother Evan Lurie, Smokey Hormel, and many more, is going to be released March 15th, which provided us the perfect reason to catch up with John, who's not just a longtime favorite of myself, but also one of Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions editor and sound designer, Andrew Horton, who joins me today from Virginia Beach. You're also a pretty big fan of John Lurie, right?
Yeah, I really like John Lurie. I'm actually reading his memoir, finally, The History of Bones. I bought it, like probably pre-ordered it or whatever, and I'm finally actually getting around to reading it because that's how reading lists work, you know?
Yeah, it comes up a lot in this talk. He's pretty proud of it, I think, and rightly so. It's a good book.
I think it's incredible, and it's funny because I just read a couple of those, the Mark Lanegan memoir, and then this, and then the Werner Herzog. So it's just it feels so of a piece with those.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny, the Herzog thing comes up in our talk too. I talk about listening to the audiobook, which is great. Lurie, I thought it was a really good book, and I think that a lot like his TV shows, it's gently surrealistic, you know what I mean? Which is sort of his vibe. On the television front, were you a fan of Fishing with John when that came out in the early 90s, or when did you kind of catch wind of it? Because it was much later for me.
Yeah, I only ever saw it during the Netflix DVD through the mail era. My ex-wife had been a film student. And she was like, have you ever seen that? And, you know, Tom Waits is on it. Jim Jarmusch is on it. And I went, oh, no, I've never even heard of this. And we got them through the mail on, you know, through Netflix through the mail. And then
it
just kind of blew my mind because it was one of those things where it really threaded that needle of being this sort of like ambient cinema kind of aimless hangout thing. But then it's deeply, dryly funny, too. So I'd be watching it just like crying laughing at certain parts.
Yeah. I thought that it was great that Painting with John is a completely different show. It's like, it's a different vibe and feel, but it maintains that nice little balance between slow TV, that sort of notion, you know, whatever, where you're watching a train, a camera mounted on a train. Slow TV is like a trend, semi-trend. I've heard Joe Pera referred to as slow comedy, which is maybe it's getting a little goofy, but I don't know if Lurie completely falls into that category given his sort of history, but nonetheless, it's got that long sections where you're just watching him paint, and that's beautiful to see, but then really funny stories, self-deprecating stories, all of this different stuff. I thought it was just a really brilliant show on top of his already brilliant run, you know?
Yeah, I feel like we're in this era where we're putting the word ambient in front of everything, but it's absolutely of a piece of this kind of ambient TV, ambient cinema thing. And what it actually really made me think of, which is a film from a couple years ago that I feel like nobody ever talks about, was this film called August at Akiko's. Did you ever see this? It was Alex Zhang Hongtai from the band Dirty Beaches.
Yeah, and I it like has them a very, a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a very similar vibe to Painting with John because it's in this very tropical kind of green location, and it's a lot of these like long shots of just greenery moving in the breeze and people living very quiet lives, and it sits right in that same zone.
Yeah.
And that's what Painting made me think of.
To me, like the fact that it ran for three seasons is kind of a crazy, wonderful, incredible miracle, you know, because it's just like, and on HBO, it's like, it's a drag to see, obviously, as the contentification sort of like destroys any shred of like legacy media. It's cool to see something like this essentially sneak in under the wire, you know what I mean? In terms of like, I'm so glad that this exists and that, you know, Adam McKay was able to, you know, really help bring it into fruition. So just yet another kind of good on you thing towards him, you know what I mean?
It feels like a little miracle. And it's one of those things, you know, whenever I've logged into the HBO app, I've never once seen it promoted to me or right. as one of the, you know, this week it's not there between Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Leftovers or whatever. It's like I literally had to search for it.
Right, which it should. I mean, it's the perfect intersection between those two shows, I'm sure, in some weird way.
Yeah, it kind of is.
You know, he and I talked a lot about his music, of course, in this chat, and I really enjoy the music on that show, especially given that the soundtrack, it kind of ties together all of his projects, Lounge Lizards, it draws from the John Lurie National Orchestra type thing, and then stuff that is recorded brand new for this show after a long time of him not being able to play music. So I really enjoy that too. But were you ever a fan of like the Lounge Lizards, or did you get into his records or Marvin Pontiac, his persona or whatever?
Yeah, I really had to work my way backwards to those because it's funny because he talks about this in the memoir, but I was one of those people that was really guilty of thinking that the whole thing was some sort of ironic put on or some sort of fake jazz. He talks about that concept of fake jazz or joke jazz. And so I always, you know, as a snotty young dude who was going back and finding all of the kind of downtown 81 New York stuff, I was like, oh, even James Chance was almost too like goofy for me. I was like, no, I don't want to gag. Sure. I want very serious transgressive art. And so it took me a long time before I got my head out of my butt on that. And eventually, once I started chasing it down, I got way into it. Love, you know, Voice of Chunk, and I got way into those records. But it took me way longer. Like, it was a long time where I knew about him before I actually chased those down.
That's okay. It's all about when you get to it, you know?
I mean, it's called The Lounge Lizards. Like, it sounds like Cherry Poppin' Daddies or something. When you're 19, right?
Right. No, I totally get what you mean. I mean, and yeah, sure, maybe some of the fashion choices back then wouldn't have entirely dissuaded you of that comparison either. But I was really excited to get him. And, you know, the thing is, it comes up in this conversation too briefly, more like in the early 2010s, he did a project with Vice where he was doing like a late night radio show, and it only lasted, I think, three episodes.
I've never
four.
Even heard of it.
Yeah, it was like a podcast YouTube thing that they did, and like so much else, it just sort of vanished into the ether. But it was so good, and he's got a great he works well in the audio medium, you know, just talking. He's a raconteur in that way. And so I was so excited to get him on the show and so glad that we could, you know, get him to spend some time reflecting on all sorts of stuff. It's like, this is, you sometimes call the episodes hangout episodes. And I would say that this one turned into that because I just sort of decided to go with the flow with his energy. And I hope that that folks enjoy listening to it.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, I can't wait to hear it myself.
I'm trying to figure out if I got turned on to John Lurie at some point by you posting something about him, you know, way back when.
Who knows? Yeah.
Andrew and I have been online friends for like more than 20 years now at this point.
A really
long
time, yeah.
Which is a pretty crazy thing to think about. But we'll have to do another hang before we roll the episode sit down soon. I think we have one on the books even. So
for sure.
Thanks for doing it, dude.
You got it.
All right, without further ado, here it is, our transmissions interview with John Lurie. Thanks for listening to Aquarium Drunkard.
Did you hear the new thing?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I've been listening to it so much.
Oh, good.
There's some.
Wait, put that on the start. Start. Put that on the record.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we'll do it. All right. John, thanks so much for joining us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. As we were just saying before we officially began the show, I've been listening to the new soundtrack for Painting with John a ton. It's like, is it 54 tracks? Is that right? It's like over 50 tracks of tunes.
You would think I would know, but I don't. I think it's the mid-50s, 54, 55, 56, 57. I'm not sure exactly.
I'm guessing 56, if I'm looking at my notes right, but okay, they could be wrong.
No, I never actually counted them.
Sure. It's a lot of music, though. It's fantastic. It's a really great, enjoyable listen.
Thanks. And you know, I cut a lot of things out, actually, where... And I know people don't listen like this anymore, but I wanted to make it one cohesive thing from beginning to end. So the sequencing and, you know, a lot of it's pre-existing songs from forever ago, but to make the volumes all match and to make it one thing. But I know people don't sit down and listen to a whole digital version anymore. I mean, I'm thinking people might listen to the LP like that, but the digital version, I made it so that it could be listened to in one thing.
That's really cool. And I think that the fact that, as you mentioned, that you're pulling from previously existing material too, stuff from the Marvin Pontiac stuff, Lounge Lizard stuff, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place, yeah.
But it doesn't feel like that, really. It feels like a very cohesive...
Good. I'm glad. I mean, but that was the work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then rejecting some pieces that didn't quite fit anywhere. And then I stuck that thing on the end, which is The Invention of Animals, which is 20-minute piece of me and Calvin Weston and Billy Martin with the John Lurie National Orchestra, a live thing, but it's at the end.
Yeah.
It's kind of doesn't quite fit in a way, but I wanted to put it on there. So
Yeah. You gotta just go with those whims. Those are a big part of the intuitive process.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
Yeah.
Well, to get this interview, you know, started, I guess we could start with a really light, easy question, which is, so...
Well, they're going to get hard later on.
Yeah, they're going to get really hard later.
I always thought, you know, before every interview, you always ask, are you going to give them a... When people say, how are you? Which I think is the most horrible question in the world.
Sure.
Because you have to answer it. You have to lie right off the bat. You have to say, I'm fine.
Immediately you start with an untruth,
And nobody is fine. So I always wonder, are you going to give them a hard time about saying, how are you? Anyways, I've interrupted your first question. Okay, I'll.
I appreciate it. And I will never ask you how you are again.
Good, thanks.
Well, so we first corresponded it was 2015 and-
14, I looked it up, 2014.
It was 14, so basically a decade ago for Aquarium Drunkard.
And I had no idea, I only know what you look like now.
Yeah, that's
I had
true.
No idea what you look like, yeah.
That's true. So it's been about a decade, but you told me back then that you were working on a book, and you've since released The History of Bones, which is a fantastic read. But at the time,
you
mentioned a book called There Has to Be a God or It Couldn't Get This Weird. Was that a different project or a potential title?
That was you know, Random House said they wanted my memoirs from the 80s, and so I ended it, you know, New Year's Eve 1990 or the next day.
Right.
And I just assumed that there would be another one.
Yeah.
But doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So,
well,
I mean, I think the book world is really struggling. So, you know.
Well,
you know, there was a
luckily the music industry is doing great, so you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry.
Yeah.
Well,
but I do hope to write the second volume of that.
It's an incredible title. It would be a shame to not put out a book called
To Waste Society. There has to be a God, or it couldn't get this weird. Yeah, I know.
What?
But then,
yeah. What are?
But then it's you're opening up. It becomes fair play for every journalist to ask, "Do you believe in God?"
Well, do you? I mean, what are your thoughts on a higher power?
Oh shit!
On a higher
I've fallen into that, and I haven't even written the book.
I know.
It changes moment to moment, but I believe that there's something going on.
Yeah.
I believe there are things we can't see that, you know, have influence and it changes all the time. I mean, my view on what happens after you die, it's 180 degrees switch, you know?
Do you mean from thinking, you know, nothing happens when you die or something?
To something happens. Yeah.
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 There's lots of reasons why something like that, you know, might happen. But I think it's good to be able to say that your thoughts on that topic aren't fixed, just because why would they be? What the fuck do we know? You know what I mean?
Well, I find the most dangerous people are the ones who, you know, are the ones who are certain. The ones, either the religious people who are certain that this is going to happen, or the prophet. I find the prophetizing atheists just as annoying as you know, the pulpit people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I came up in a pretty thoroughly American, conservative, Christian, you know, sort of like upbringing. And
yeah,
it sounds real similar when you hear those sort of moralizing atheists talk about the futility of all this shit and how it doesn't mean anything. But you hear...
My parents were both atheists.
Yeah.
Like devout atheists. And I think it... So I, you know...
Yeah.
I had a thing that happened when I was like 19 or 20 that just went, whoa. Yeah. It's in the book, actually. I had a thing that happened, you know, like.
Is that the part? Is that the part where you get your tenor sax? And
it's right around there. It's right around there. But it's called Inside God's Brain, where I was riding on a bicycle in the middle of the night. And then this thing happened.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious if you appear in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
An incredible film, one that was a big part of my spiritual, you know, sort of like expanding my spiritual worldview.
Really? Did you read the book? Because the book, I mean, I don't think the movie does justice to the book. The book is just like,
no, I never have, but I have read, I mean, I've watched the movie a bunch, but I've never read the book.
Yeah.
So maybe I need to, but I'm curious, did that, you know, have any impact on your view of this stuff?
No.
It's a gig.
Well, I was going to direct a movie and I wanted to watch Marty work. He was a hero of mine.
Yeah.
And, I really blew it. I mean, I just really blew it. I just really blew it. And me and Marty just didn't, we went off of each other in a bad way.
Yeah.
But I asked him, could I watch him work? And they're shooting out in the desert. And I asked him a couple of questions, but I realized that, like, I'm not supposed to be doing that. You know, he answered one question and the next one he didn't answer. And then I thought, oh, I should lay back here. I shouldn't be bugging him. And then after a couple hours, I went for a walk. And we're out in the desert. And it's just beautiful. But I somehow got turned around and I walk up on top of this giant hill of sand, and I'm right. I mean, they're about to shoot. I didn't ruin the shot, but I come up over the hill and they're down there on the bottom of the hill and they're about to shoot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're the new guy in a new place with new people and you've just done something like this. It was just like, oh man, I'm an asshole. So then on the next day, the call sheet, you know, it says what actors they need, who they need the next morning. And it says, if you are not in the scene, do not come to the set. And it really should have said, John Lurie, don't, you know. But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that film. You know, I mentioned that part of the book where you talk about getting your tenor sax and you say,
yeah.
I'll quote you here. You said, there are moments when some force in life parts the clouds and says, hi, it's me, God. I was hiding, but now I'm back. Here's a little something to nudge you in the right direction. And I'm curious, what nudged you in the direction of doing a show like Painting with John and returning to music?
But that was also,
that
Painting with John was completely given to us. It really was. It wasn't like, let's do a show for HBO.
Yeah.
What? You've met Nesrin,
right.
And you have someone. So we're mostly living in Grenada was where we were living.
That's where you were at the time. You're back in New York now, is that right?
Yeah, but I tend to not. I mean, why we kept the island secret was because of the stalker situation I had, and I've always sort of just been careful about this.
Well, sure.
But it's just now it's second nature to be careful about never saying where I am because I don't think it's a problem anymore. But so we're in Grenada, and we got to go back because you can't go to the dentist there. You can't go to the doctor there. So we're coming back for some reason.
Right.
But I was in the middle. I do these paintings, and I invent techniques as I'm going. And I usually have several going against the wall. And sometimes I pull one back up, and she's like, how the fuck did I do that? I don't know how I did that.
Right.
So she's going to film me on her phone doing this technique before we go back to New York. And we started teasing each other. And it was really funny. So I said, and she'd been wanting to for a long time to post things on Instagram. She runs the Instagram page. And so we were just going to like do these things, you know, for 1 minute things to post on Instagram to cheer people up. Because between, you could feel COVID was going to be this giant thing, and it was Trump, and it was children in cages, and people were just in such a grim mood. And so we're going to do this thing to cheer people up. And there's this kid, Eric Marcus, who had done, I had met him, I don't know, on Facebook or Twitter or something. And I used to try, I do less now, where I would respond to people if they wrote to me on social media. I would try to respond.
Yeah.
And then I got fed up because so many people say, oh, will you look at my paintings? Will you listen to my music? Will you, you know, and health questions, you know, Lyme disease, my uncle has Lyme and what did you know? And I would try to always answer.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, sometimes it's like one an hour.
It gets so impossible.
And I was getting fed up with it. And I get this email or a message. I can't remember how it was, Facebook. Or, I have something that I think I'd like you to see. And I said, and I kind of got, and I said, you know what? I'm sick of this. Never mind. And then an hour later, I said, why be rude to this guy? And so I wrote him back saying, apologizing. And what he had done was he had put together the opening titles of Fishing with John in a loop, a 1 hour loop. and he put it on YouTube, and it's kind of this surreally relaxing thing. Okay. So then, and then he also made a little video for I Don't Have a Cow, one of the Marvin Pontiac songs on the Asylum tapes. So, okay. I said, Nesrin, why don't we have this kid come and he can videotape it so we'll be free so neither one of us will have to shoot these 1 minute things.
Yeah.
And Nesrin said, what is he going to live with us? And then, so then he came to New York and we met him and we liked him. And then we were going to get him a hotel room, but he said, no, he didn't need it. He was going to stay at a youth hostel, but he never found it. And we didn't find out till the next day. He spent the night walking around Manhattan with nowhere to stay until he left in the morning. And that kind of sold me on him. Okay. You know, like, and so he came and he was so good at everything.
Yeah.
He was just good at shooting sound. And the two of us together, well, this could actually be something. So then we spent 6 weeks, a couple of months, just shooting these painting, which it wasn't Painting with John yet, but it looked like it could be something, a movie or a TV show. And we were just doing it. And And then it was just completely by accident. I always say no to doing these podcasts, but this guy, Matt Dwyer, has, you know, he was such a nice guy the way he asked, okay, I'll do it. And then I said, what are you working on now? I said, well, we're working on this thing, a painting with John, but I don't know what's it. Well, do you mind if I show it to Adam McKay? I said, no, I don't mind. And then Adam McKay says, do you mind if I show this to HBO? And then it's like, I had to get a lawyer to do this.
Yeah.
And I was recommended this lawyer. And she, well, first I went to two or three lawyers who were recommended, and it was just like, you have to send them your financials to make sure that you're like auditioning to become a client of these law firms. So they take a percentage of your earnings. And if you don't make enough, and I was just like, Jesus, I don't qualify to be, you know, a client of these law. So that made me feel terrible. And then this other lawyer who owned, somebody recommended, and she was just like, well, this is ridiculous. No, there's no channel that's going to want this thing, because we sent her, you know, a half hour of it, and just made me feel terrible about it. And then a half hour later, Adam McKay called and said, HBO wants it. And this had to scrape Nezrin off the ceiling. She was so excited. But it just all happened by accident. It all fell into place, you know. And when the lawyer told me, like, nobody's going to want to buy this, nobody's going to want to watch this, I believed her, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, it's an unusual show. I mean, in every way, right? Pacing, visuals, content. It's even more unusual than Fishing with John, which was a fairly unusual television outing. But the fact that it got three seasons in this in this age where things get canceled as tax write-offs every 5 seconds, and some beloved thing gets scraped off of the internet like it's nothing. You know, the fact that you got three seasons of this show into the world, it's kind of miraculous. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, and also what was miraculous, I just assumed everybody at HBO was going to be like these really snobby assholes. And it was the opposite of that. Everybody we worked with there was great, you know, just like to make the trailers and the poster and the, you know, the publicity. And I really liked work. And it seems to like this Max thing, it seems like maybe it's changing, going more corporate, but it was wonderful when we were there.
You got it. I mean, it really is. It's like an incredible show, and it is like a fun to have it. It was one of those things that during, you know, like you said, the original kind of maybe idea was to cheer people up. And I think it had that effect, but just like everything else, it was really funny, you know, but it was also poignant at times. It was also very surreal. It was kind of,
and it was also really well put together, I think.
I mean, definitely.
Yeah. And we really worked hard on it, you know, just the editing and the music and the sound. And yeah, but what we're going to try and do next, but I don't know if it's going to fly. Eric's coming in a couple of weeks, and we're going to start out where I'm going to say at the beginning, we're going to do this thing, but we don't know what it is. And we've invited you in early so you can watch us make it.
That's interesting.
And watch us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to just start from scratch. And I know I want to see a tornado, and I want to catch a rattlesnake.
These are your stated objectives, but that's
it. And also maybe meeting Werner Herzog, but you can't use a phone or a computer or anything other than word of mouth to find out where he is.
Okay.
So that may not, and all of these things could fail. You know, so, but it will really be about us. And I talk to strangers all the time on the street. So it'll be that and us traveling to find a tornado and to find a rattlesnake and to look for Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog. But I don't know. Yeah. Whose book, I was listening to it on audiobook. His book is called Every Man for Himself and God Against All. So apparently I just want to read books with God in the title. That's my thing.
But
yeah, so
does it say where he is in that book?
I was listening to it through an app that's like a library app. It's different because I got so fed up with Amazon owning Audible, and it's like everything is like owned by like three corporations. So I'm trying to do this library thing where it's like they give you audiobooks, but it's through my local library. The only problem is it's just like a library. You only have a set amount of time. And I can't finish Werner Herzog's audio. You have to give it back. Yeah. But then you can put back in. Anyway, long story short, I didn't make it to the end, but I don't think he reveals his location. So you're probably going to have to start fresh. Yeah.
All right. Well, actually, this maybe wouldn't have counted anyways, because this is actually using a computer to find out where he is.
That's true. That's true. So so regardless, but I mean, that sounds great. I like the idea that you're going to start making something before you know what it is. Because it sounds like that's the way it was with Painting with John, too, though.
Yeah, kind of. And we don't have money to make this either, so.
Yeah, well, so there's that. Well, you know, it's funny. I think in some ways of you as somebody who TV's obviously been a big part of your work and your career, sometimes when I get sad, you know, or down, I'll just watch Lounge Lizards doing Voice of Chunk on Night Music.
Oh, really?
Night.
I don't think I've ever seen. Well, we did Voice of Chunk and Uncle Jerry, maybe?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. No, that was with Rebo taking that wild sobo. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, that came out okay.
Look, all I'll say is that talking about weird shows that you can't believe existed, Night Music remains one of the most that, like, you know.
Yeah, but it would make sense that something like that would exist.
Back then.
But it was a miracle that it was on, but
but it makes sense, you're saying, because there was still an infrastructure. There was like a culture that cared about things a little bit.
Yeah, and
weird.
And I think they struggled the whole time. But you know, to have the best live music on from around the world, how can that not be a thing? You know,
I mean, the fact that it, you know, I think that part of what makes it right was Hal Wilner's madcap. Like sorting and combining things that on paper look like different things, but in practice you see the commonality. You know, to me that's so brilliant. You know, and he was that again, that it was a TV show that you could be like flipping through the channels one night, and then all of a sudden you're seeing, I don't know what, Screamin' Jay Hawkins with Bob Weir and Palm Water.
But the Screamin' Jay Hawkins. One, somebody asked me what was the best thing ever on that, and it was Screamin' Jay Hawkins, where he jumped up. It was I Put a Spell on You, but he jumps up from the keyboard and goes, no, 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 and he's spinning around in a circle, and it kind of really makes the TV fall off the stand. It just was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was also thinking about the Voice of Chunk TV commercial that you made, mm-hmm. which, I mean... To me, one, it's a classic of that medium, you know, the sort of infomercial or CD by mail campaign.
Yeah, I remember, but it was before, and there was hardly anything. It was only 4 channels or 10 channels when we did it, and Boxcar Willie was the only person selling music on the TV.
Right. So you were stepping out a little bit and trying something. I mean, I have to imagine that cost an arm and a leg.
Yeah, lost all my money. but I was convinced. But also, I'm such a child with this kind of thing, where once I got it up and running, then I didn't pay any attention to the company anymore. I went off on tour, and you know, and it fell apart.
Sure.
So
sure.
And it was 90 cents a call, and then we'd pay for every call that came in. So 90 cents for every call that came in, and there'd be all these people calling to just find out what kind of music it was.
Yeah.
And so then I did I tested it myself. I called, it was 1-800-44-CHUNK. And one of the things was that we were the 1-800-44-CHUCK was a weapons thing or something. And people were calling our number by mistake all the time. So 90 cents each time somebody did that. But then also people would call, say what kind of music it was. And then, so I tried it, and you get these operators who are reading this thing, and it's obviously a single mom who is her second job, and she's working in the middle of the night, and she's reading this thing, something about African Coltrane, Jamie Coltrane, you know, and it's like, this is costing me 90 cents, lady.
Yeah, it did. That doesn't sound like it was ultimately worth it, but the commercial itself is very good. And I would have ordered it, I think. I think. Had I been.
It did kind of work. Yeah. It just didn't, you know. I paid for the record, and then I paid for the company, and Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I had to start. I mean, my uncle had died, and Evan, my brother, and Liz, my sister, both bought the apartment, bought nice apartments, and I took the money and made the record and then put it on TV and lost all of it. I might as well just have had a gambling problem.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry I did that at all. I'm glad that exists, and, you know.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. A million plus artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. Thinking about something like night music, you know, it kind of baffles my mind that you can't buy like a Criterion Collection Blu-ray of that or something. The way you can buy Fishing with John, was the Criterion Collection put out a version of it. I don't know if it's still in print
That was rare. No, it is. Yeah. And that was rare that they did that. But
do you think that there will be like a physical version of Painting with John either?
You would think, but you can't. I mean, like, there's a lot of territories that Painting with John didn't come out.
Yeah.
And it sort of says that we then, if it doesn't come out, then we can sell it to those territories. But you can't really get an answer. I guess there's these, you know, global deals going on between, you know, whoever and Germany and who, you know, and HBO. And so you can't really find out even. I could never really get an answer. It's like, is it going to ever be on in Japan?
Yeah.
And you could never really even get an answer. So it just becomes, I suppose if you have a high-powered agent and a high-powered lawyer, but I don't have those things.
Well, I hope that it does, and I hope that people over there can see it, and I hope that it comes out in some physical version just so that I can. I like to hang on to those, the ones that I really like, you know, and it's great, you know.
But then in 10 years, what are you going to play it on? There won't be, you won't have a DVD player. You won't, you know,
I guess that's true. Hopefully they'll keep making them. There's all sorts of antiquated technology you can buy online if you look around. So maybe I'll have to keep a working Blu-ray player in order. That might be a tough one. I've still got one. So anyway.
Well, it was also weird for me, like making the Marvin, the Asylum tapes, and then.
You mean the vinyl edition that came out recently?
Well, yeah, because I mean, I got sick and I didn't do music for 17 years. And so then, well, nobody buys CDs anymore. Some people, collectors buy vinyl. Most people get their music digitally. And so what we thought it might work, but it didn't with the Asylum tape. So we make the record and we put it on Spotify. And I was warned against Bandcamps, but now my whole catalog is on Bandcamp.
Yeah, that's good.
But at the time we were warned against. So, and we just talked about it on social media and it didn't really work. You know what I mean? And I'm hoping this Painting with John record will take people back to the Asylum tapes record. Cause yeah,
it's great. It's great. You know, I was thinking about that thing that you'd mentioned, that there was a long break where you weren't playing music at all. I mean, your situation in the early 2000s, your situation with Lyme disease really took music off the table for you.
Yeah. I couldn't even listen.
You couldn't listen because it...
Neurologically, it was
uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was like whatever makes music enjoyable to your nervous system, it did the opposite of that. And it depended a lot on the music, but I couldn't go to a restaurant or, you know, the sound would just kill, you know, became really, I couldn't even go into supermarkets because the fluorescent lights.
They make a buzz.
they make a buzz that would just, I would be feel like I was being stung by bees. I mean, it was really,
yeah,
you know, when it was really bad, when the Lyme disease is just the weirdest fucking disease. I mean, and it changes day to day. You know, it's like, oh, I can't use my left arm today. Oh, now everything looks like static, you know, every day was something. Now what's it going to be tomorrow? You know, like that.
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, you know, the guys, some of the guys you're playing with on this new soundtrack, and the fact that you guys have that incredible episode where you see you in the studio at work making this stuff, it was really touching. But in the case of some of these guys, you've been playing with them for a very long time, right?
30 years, some of them. Yeah, I mean,
what does it feel like at this point? You know, I'm curious on an emotional level what that felt like for you after so long of not doing that. What did it feel like to
return to it? It's a complicated road, actually, because, you know, got really sick and didn't hear from anybody for years. I mean, I felt abandoned and bitter and fell out with some people over it.
Yeah.
And then, but that was just so heartwarming. I mean, and they were all there for it, you know?
Yeah.
They were really there. It was nice. It was really nice. I mean, I've been close to some of them throughout, but some of them was just like, well, where'd you go? You know?
Yeah.
But no, it was really a really good feeling. And it was also lucky because I don't know how you do it without the show. How would you pay for that? You know?
Right. 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 I mean, because that's the thing, you know, you want to make sure everybody's compensated and that everybody is, you know, able to do something like that. It's a big use of time. But the vibe that you guys all had together,
it was good.
It seemed very natural. Really nice. And and on the record, you know, everything just has the kind of the way you explore and thread the line between various things, these sort of like a lot of banjo, a lot of killer banjo on the record, obviously.
I'm really proud of the banjo. I think the banjo stuff is the most soulful stuff on there. Though there's lots of mistakes, and me and Eric had to kind of go through and edit it up a bunch to make it palatable. But the banjo stuff touches me the most in a way.
What do you like so much about it? What do you like about the instrument?
It's just like, well, wait, I mean, I don't know what you... Just the sound. It may sound, you know, because it doesn't sound the way I play it. It doesn't sound like a Western instrument. It sounds like I found it, you know, in Nairobi somewhere on the street. You know, I mean, it's just, I tune it weird and it's got a, but I love that metal string sound and the body of it. I really love the way, but not the way, you know, normal people play it. But,
you know, I think of it as, you're somebody who obviously you're a composer, you know, you play sax, you play guitar, you're all over the map there, but there's always such a rhythmic quality to your work and rhythm is of primary importance to you. The banjo almost feels to me like a drum, you know, and a guitar.
Kind of, but rhythmically I played it really poorly. So yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of groove stuff on the record, which, you know, it's also the guys. I mean, you can write some boom, 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 and it's like nothing. And then Tony Scheer picks it up and like, oh, it sounds like something now, you know, and then put Calvin Weston on drums behind it. And it's like, oh, this is happening. So,
right.
You know.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a really fun. It's a really fun one. And I mean, the fact that you're able to, as we touched on this in the beginning, but you pull from your past discography too, and it just ends up creating like a very interesting narrative flow. And that is, good. You know, that's really fantastic. And, you know, so it's interesting though that you were able to show that on the show. That was something you filmed earlier and then aired later? Is that how that worked? Or
yeah, we filmed it. We did the music before we shot the episode.
Right.
And we didn't really plan for that to be an episode. And then
what made it make sense that it should be one? Because I'm glad it is, that's for sure.
Well, one, Eric and also Enrico, God, what the hell's Enrico's last name? Poe? Enrico, who was just the kid, the assistant running around doing things, but he filmed a lot of stuff on his phone. And we just had enough to pull it together, you know, but I didn't think it was going to be enough to make a whole episode. But Eric did a pretty great job of putting that together, actually. I didn't see it, and he pulled it. He made it happen.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask about one of my favorite episodes of the show was another semi-music-focused one. It's when you had Flea over. And, you know, for a long time, I was never really a huge fan of the Chili Peppers, but Flea always struck me as like a really pure soul. And now I can also listen to a lot of Chili Pepper stuff and really kind of get what they were doing. I went back and listened to One Hot Minute for this interview just because you're on that. But
I'm not on it, though. I mean, when the Flea called me and said, I was doing him a favor. He asked me to come out to L.A. and then he had to do something else. So I was alone in the studio with Rick Rubin, who was on the phone the whole time. And we just kept saying, yeah, play like you're at a party. He said that four times. But I went out there and then Flea calls me. It was when the record was done. He said, well, I just wanted to tell you that you're still on the record, but only a dog can hear it.
Yeah, because, I mean, listening to it, you don't. It's definitely not a prominently mixed harmonica.
No, you can't hear. I don't think I'm on it. I mean, I played saxophone and harmonica on like six things. But Flea, going back to Flea, I see this stuff on the internet saying what a horrible person he is. And that he can't, or other ones that say, oh, he can't really play. And it's just like, it makes me furious. And he doesn't seem to care. But this guy,
good for
of
him.
all the famous people I know, it's just like, his heart is in the right place. He's just kind and generous. And he can play. And his trumpet playing is really good now. I mean, great. He sounds like, his tone is just, he sounds like an old soul on the trumpet, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's weird to have to, I mean, but he's just such a good, I mean, I know a lot of people who got famous and then changed and, you know, fame is such a weird thing. And there should be special counseling sessions for people who get famous because it changes people. And it's hard to deal with. It's a very hard thing to deal. But he's really, his soul is first. I mean, it just is, you know, he's really special.
I saw him do a talk for his book, Acid for the Children, and it was just...
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was just incredible. I mean, it just like... Yeah. So, I mean, heart on his sleeve entirely.
Yeah.
You know, and that made me think about the fact that he... I think he also called in for a very short amount of time, actually right before we first talked. You were doing that late night call-in thing with Vice.
Oh, yeah. With Vice, yeah.
And Flea was on it, right? Along with Steve Buscemi and Evan.
Buscemi and Evan,
Lurie, your brother, of course.
Yeah.
I loved that show. There was only the few of those episodes ever existed, but it was just so cool. And, you know, now that Vice is in the process of basically falling apart, it's weird to wonder.
Good. They kind of were,
They were kind of, was it a terrible situation with them?
Yeah, that wasn't nice at all. It really wasn't nice. And and it was supposed to be like there was somebody screening the calls.
Wasn't
before
happening?
They came in. No, but then people could just call right in. And it was so uncomfortable. The whole thing was uncomfortable. And then I'm all, you know, showered and dressed and ready to go. And then they canceled me, like, you know, oh, we can't do it this week. It was just really disrespectful all the way around.
Yeah.
And they said, there were some things I didn't want to talk about because there had been that horrible New Yorker article and there was the stalker situation. So I had to be careful in that direction. And then they advertised it as ask John Lurie anything you want. It was just like, fuck, I didn't agree to this, you know?
Right. I mean, you don't necessarily, that's what Twitter is for, right? That's for strangers to yell at you.
Yeah, they've sort of stopped. I don't get that much ugly stuff on social media.
I mean, that's great. And you're you're still on X or whatever we call it now.
Yeah, yeah. You know what?
Is it more?
You know, you talked about books and Amazon and stuff. It's like, you don't stop ordering shit because you think Bezos is an asshole. So why stop using Twitter? Because it really is better than the other ones as far as like, I want to find out this morning what's happening in Rafah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I can go search Rafah and find out, you know, what's happened there that day.
Right.
And, or you never know, with this particular subject, you never know who's telling the truth, but you can get some idea what's going on, whereas Threads or Blue Sky, or it's really hard to really get a handle on to search things. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't, they're not very satisfying. And I do think that, like, this year I have gone through different phases where I've deleted X from like my phone or Twitter or whatever. And I just will log in desktop when I need to share something like this show, you know, sucks.
Yeah.
It sucks to not have that platform to push this out there so that people know when there are episodes, you know? So it's like, I'm still using it for that, but I definitely think that in 2024, I'm working on limiting my exposure to social media.
Well,
you know?
I mean, I was addicted to it for a while.
Yeah.
And a few years ago. And well, you know, the weirdest thing was I have terrible sleep problems. You know? So I'm sleeping in the afternoon. We're in Grenada. And I have this dream. I just had met Anthony Bourdain on Twitter, and we were sending private messages. And then I had this dream that me and him were doing a podcast on how to curb your Twitter addiction.
Sure.
That was the dream. And I come downstairs and open the computer, and there's an email from Anthony Bourdain asking me to be on his show. He must have been sending that email at the same time I was having the dream.
That's
so
weird.
So he asked me if I believe in other stuff. Shit like that happens, you know?
Yeah.
Gotta mean something.
I mean, that's the sort of thing where it's like, somebody could say, oh, that's just a coincidence. And maybe that's true, right? Maybe it's a coincidence.
No, but I had a friend, I don't know if this is a famous quote or it was just a friend, he said, coincidence is God's way of saying hello.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, when something like that happens, it feels uncanny to us. We feel something beyond ourselves, and we choose to invest that with meaning. I think that's incredible. I finally watched the Bourdain doc last year. I'd put it off for years because I was just nervous to watch it. You know, not for any reason other than just my own sort of whatever imagination or feelings about, you know, Anthony Bourdain. But I found a lot of it really moving, especially your guys' stuff together and you talking. I mean, that was really, I think that was important, and so I was.
Me and Helen are the only ones who didn't cry.
Yeah,
we were proud of that. I didn't cry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but what? I mean, the episode that you guys did together is great, and you know, so I think, you know, he was a great force on Twitter. You're a good. I like your. You've been a great follow all of these years. It's so.
I've really slowed it down.
Which is great. I mean, now you know. I think it's good to do that, but it's another just great platform for your art, for the show, for the music, all of that. But you know, I wanted to ask you something that you had mentioned earlier, that when you first started writing the book. I want to jump back to the book.
Nelson's going to be mad at you, though, if you don't talk more about music.
I do have some more music coming up. I promise.
All right.
The book, though, you talked about how one of my favorite quotes from it is you're talking about a former collaborator, and you write, "We are all flawed. We are all flawed. We are all flawed." Mm-hmm. You read it three times, you know, in a row.
Yeah.
And then you go on to say, in a way, that is the point of this whole thing, how we are all individually, uniquely flawed. I think that line's really profound and empathetic. And I think that it's important to the process of empathy to think about that. But I know that when you said that when you first started writing the book, it was more bitter. I don't think that bitterness is still in the book. What was it
like? Oh, God, go to Goodreads and read what people say. It's just like, oh, he's so bitter, he's so bitter, he's so bitter. I mean, it was just like,
I mean,
because there is one chapter where I talk about every fucked up thing that happened to me, you know, that got it, you know, either, you know, that sabotaged what I was doing or made the music sound bad in a movie, or, you know, I talk about all of it in one chapter.
Yeah.
And I say at the beginning, because the book was going to be, I was really writing the more book when I first got sick, and then kind of really was bitter that, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to fall into, you know, isolation and, you know, and be forgotten. And it was kind of bitter, and I didn't, you know, so I went through it when Random House asked that I do something about the 80s, I took the 80s section out and then cleaned the bitterness out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
but the All Flawed section was written back when I started writing it in 2002. I've been interrupting you now terribly, so
no,
you can get back to you.
No, it's totally fine. It made me think a little bit, you know, about when Anthony Bourdain wrote Kitchen Confidential. He left, mm-hmm. you know, he would sometimes thinly veil the people he was writing mm-hmm. about, you know, but people knew mm-hmm. who he was talking about.
Yeah.
You obviously were faced with that choice too, right? Where it's like, what do I say? What do I hold back? What do I, you know, well, what line do I walk? It's just an interesting thing to navigate as somebody who's had so many creative ins and outs. That's just the way it is, you know?
I wanted to be 100% honest
yeah.
about myself and other people without needlessly hurting anybody. But I know a lot of people were upset after it came out, and not even people I didn't mean to hurt.
Yeah.
And because, you know, okay, if John's willing to say anything about himself, they didn't sign up for that. So
yeah.
Is that fair to throw them, you know, out, you know, into the light like that? Maybe not. But, you know, there's that book by Art Pepper, was it Straight Life? Or, I think.
I know the title, but I actually haven't ever read that book.
It's insane. He talks with complete honesty about being a peeping Tom.
Wow.
And
okay.
It's just like.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make you like him anymore, but it's just like, what? There were two things. There was that book and that documentary about Crumb.
The Terry Zwigoff, is that who did that?
Yeah, yeah, good. I wasn't going to remember his name. Thank you. Yeah, you got it. That was so honest. And that makes you hate Crumb, but
yeah,
the honesty of it, I felt like the only way it has value
right.
is to be completely honest, to not manicure it, to not. And so I tried to do that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know a lot of people will never, you know, but fuck it.
I mean, look, I appreciate that that's where you land on it, because it's a great read. One of the things in terms of that honesty, you talk about this early experience you have with Canned Heat. And, mm-hmm. you know, just the other day I heard some people on the Tim Heidecker podcast. They were talking a little bit about Canned Heat and how much that stuff sounds great at the time. But, you know, as a harmonica player, was that one of the you know, kind of most important bands to you in the early days? And what was it like hearing stuff like Little Walter?
I mean,
you know?
That's a jump.
That is a jump.
Alan Wilson was special in that band. And then he had died by the time I played with them.
Right.
But, and then, you know, I'm playing with John Lee Hooker, I'm 17 years old. That was okay. That was something amazing. But
I mean, and it's funny because the harmonica is not the thing that most people associate you with. You know what I mean?
It's my first instrument. I don't think anybody ever talks about me on the harmonica. I thought my playing on the Marvin records is pretty good, but people don't notice the harmonica. You know what the best thing I thought about the Flower Moon thing?
Oh, the Killers of the Flower Moon?
Yeah, yeah.
Was that
harmonica player, he's something, whoever the hell that is. I never actually looked it up, but he really can play.
And it's
very original sounding stuff. I mean, I thought the score sucked and was really lazy.
Oh.
But that harmonica player is something.
Well, Robbie will forgive you, I'm sure. I liked it.
Nah, I don't. Yeah, you liked the score?
I did.
Man, they just jammed over these scenes. They didn't even like.
Yeah.
You know, but anyways, but Little Walter.
We
discovered Little Walter with 15 or 16 and just. I mean, he became a deity. He took this country instrument and turned it into this sophisticated. He's unbelievable, Little Walter.
Yeah.
I mean, just unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about another harmonica performance, because this one kind of surprised me. But, you know, I was cruising through your credits and I hadn't heard that Loneliness song, William Shatner?
William Shatner, yeah.
Okay, so I look at this and I go, what is this? It kind of looks like an old album. It kind of looks like a 70s thing or something.
No,
but that's
it's
just
recent.
The cover. Yeah, it's obviously, yeah. It's a recent one. I think it's from 2021. But I press play on this loneliness thing, and for a while I was waiting for you to show up vocally, because it says featuring, you know, John Lurie. But then I realized, oh, that's John on harmonica, and you're killing it.
Nah, I'm just wading through it. I mean, but...
No, it's
Pat
fun.
Dillard, Pat Dillard, who did a lot of stuff on the Marvin record. Oh, what the guy's name who produced it? I've forgotten. I only met him the once, but he was a really nice guy.
Yeah, who produced the Shatner thing, you mean?
Yeah. And he just happened to be there when I went to see Pat Dillard. And then Pat emails me and says, do you want to come in and play on this William Shatner thing? I think, presuming I was going to say no. But I'd like this producer, whose name I can't remember, quite a bit. And so I said, sure, I'll come in. And then, no, but it's really pedestrian what I do. I just sort of wander through it. And I did actually, but I warned them because I very... Because Pat wasn't even paying attention. It's a long song, and I'm just sort of meandering through on the harmonica. And I said a couple times, what? William Shatner says something really, really heavy. Oh, he says, is this it? Is this the end of my existence? And I leaned into my, yes, it is. You know, and I did a few things like that.
Oh,
but Pat didn't notice.
I wish that they would have included him, though.
No. I warned him so he could take it. No, that was because William would have been crushed, but apparently we in the business call him Bill, but
so do you know him? I mean,
no, and there was supposed to be a phone call,
never
William
happened.
Shatner's gonna I missed it or something. I can't remember what happened.
Well, I was
William Shatner's gonna call you at 4 o'clock and I couldn't do it, so I think I probably had a dentist.
Yeah. Yeah, the bane of all calls and podcast booking. Yeah.
But back to that Bezos thing. Did you ever see where they go up into space and come back down and then they get out? And William Shatner's clearly had this experience and is just trying to articulate what he's gone through. And you just feel like it's going to be this immensely poetic thing. And he's sort of stammering. And then Bezos walks in with these girls in bikinis and opens a bottle of champagne and completely knocks him off the camera.
I mean, it was just the most you couldn't script it if you tried. Yeah. Dumbness of our age. Because Shatner talked about how profoundly moved he was and how what he basically felt up there was a feeling of grief for what we have done to the planet and this immense sense of responsibility about it, you know? And then, like you said, Bezos is wearing like a dumb cowboy hat or something.
Oh, well. And that's everything right there. That moment is the whole thing.
But, I mean, look, for good or ill, folks are going to be able to listen to this new soundtrack on Amazon Music, Apple Music, Spotify, anywhere people listen to it. I really do.
You're talking about Shatner or my thing? Because it makes it sound like you're talking about the Shatner thing. And so it was a good segue there, but you have to make it clear that you segued into my music.
I want to make it clear we're talking about the Painting with John soundtrack.
Although you can listen to
Bill in those other places as well.
Oh, you could listen to them both at the same time.
That's an idea. John, it's been such a blast hanging out with you and chatting
with
you.
That's an hour already?
It's been an hour, yeah. Thank you so much.
Cool. All right. Yeah.
We appreciate it.
I was dreading to. I was in a horrible mood. And that, you know, and then Nesrin says, you always don't want to do them, and then you don't want to stop.
Well, John, I appreciate it. I'm so glad we were able to chat. This new collection is so much fun, and it's been really incredible rapping with you.
All right. I'll talk to you in 10 years.
All right. Sounds good. Check in another decade. Thanks so much for listening. We're pleased to have you with us here on Transmissions. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I produce, write, and host the show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton, and our music comes from Frank Mastin, drawn from his incredible discography of gorgeous library music. You can find more of it by visiting mastin.bandcamp.com. That's mastin.bandcamp.com. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett, and our executive producer is Aquarium Drunkard's founder, Justin Gage. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35 at 7 p.m. Pacific Time each and every Wednesday. Aquarium Drunkard is powered by the support of our Patreon pledgers. If you dig what we're doing here at Aquarium Drunkard and you want to help us keep doing it, the Patreon is the best way that you can chip in financially. Your payments there help go towards us paying writers and hosting all of the various things that we host online for you to listen to. So it's a great way for you to help us out. If you're looking for something that say, maybe doesn't cost any money, but just a little bit of your time, you can always leave us a rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can spread a link here and there. Just whatever you can do to let people know about this show is certainly appreciated. You can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if so moved. But of course, I always just encourage you to send the show direct to somebody who you think might dig it. It makes a big difference here on our end. If you want to get in touch directly, you can find my contact info at Aquarium Drunkard. It's in the contact section right there in the top left-hand corner of the page. So click away. You can find me at jasonpwoodbury@gmail.com and send me your thoughts on the show or ideas or concerns, whatever. I like to hear from listeners. Transmissions is a part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. We will be back next week with another all-new episode. I'll be joined by rock writer extraordinaire and rocker herself, Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style, who joins me for a good old-fashioned total music nerd out. I think you're really going to enjoy it, and I hope you will come back. Thanks so much. Be well in the meantime. This transmission is concluded.